Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello. The world's really loud today. Outside. It's raucous and rambunctious for a Sunday afternoon. Yeah, I record this before you hear it. It's not live when I'm talking to you at the start of the podcast. That's recorded. I know, the wonders of modern technology. How are you all? It's been a while. Well, it's only been 2 weeks. But, you know, it feels like a while. I've been quite busy trying to do the old earning of rent and stuff. But there being a little gap in the podcasts meant I had a little bit of additional time to write some music, which has been awesome, to be fair. It's still the thing I love to do most. Anyway, welcome to episode 8 of Falling Forward with Dan Lesac. This week's guest is someone who works in the music industry, making the most of it for artists, helping artists to connect with their audience in an actual meaningful way, rather than in a grubby, cash-grabby way. His name's Darren Hemmings. He runs a company called Motive Unknown. If you're in the music industry, you probably... That's my doorbell. One sec, I'll be back. I'm back. That was the Labour Party at my door. Talking about the elections this week. Yeah, don't forget, if you listen to this on Tuesday or Wednesday... In the UK, you've got the EU elections to vote on. I ain't going to tell you who to vote for, but I know who you shouldn't vote for, you know? Shitposting YouTubers who will just say anything for a buck. But also, look at who you've got the choice between. And think of it like your car. You know, if your car isn't working, do you... get the guy who's just going to go sit in your car and tell your car how shit it is over and over again? Or do you go for the guy or girl who's going to get in your car and try to fix it? Try to fix the problem of the car, you know? Anyway. Music industry stuff. We've talked about that, haven't we? It's a good podcast this week. It's a really good one. Really awkward segue. I'm leaving this in. Also, I just really want to say thank you to everyone who's throwing support over on Patreon. We're getting really close to $100 a month, and that makes it far, far easier for me to do this. Especially as I still, my own insistence that I have to go travel to everyone and sit down and talk to them face to face. But that is just because it makes it far easier. If you don't know the person, it's so much easier to build a rapport in person than it is on the phone. Like, you can't see the cool faces I'm pulling right now, all the sincerity and gratitude in my face, even though you can't hear it in my voice. Because I'm not an actor. I'm not good at that. But yeah, and if you're not already supporting on Patreon, I'm not going to guilt trip you into it or anything, you know. I'm not going to make you feel bad about it. That you're listening to this and all my hard work and stuff. I'm not going to make you feel bad about that. Damn. But yeah, it's patreon.com/DanLesac is what I'm trying to say. This is the dumbest intro. I haven't done it in a fortnight. Also, talking about fortnightly, we're going to stay fortnightly for a little while. Maybe 3 or 4 episodes, and we'll see where we're after that. partially because I have to go away and visit my lady wife because she lives in the States, so, you know, I need to see her. But also because the pod being fortnightly probably avoids me getting any old guest. Not that I would just take any old chaff for the pod, but there is a bit of me that realises now that it's a lot of work to get a fresh guest every single week. Like how Pip does too some weeks is amazing to me. Although I think he might have like 500 episodes pre-recorded. I don't even know if he's still alive. I think he may be some sort of Weekend at Bernie's type character at this point, and his mates are just putting out the podcasts for him. Why did I think of Weekend at Bernie's? But yeah, hang about the end for who's up next week and stuff. Oh, music, again, is all stuff off danlasack.bandcamp.com. Oh, and yeah, if you are a Patreon or a Twitch sub, you got the tracks from the Philosophy Tube episode in your inboxes, so make sure you look for those as well. Bit of a rambling intro this week, like every other week. Anyway, on with the show. This is me and Darren Hemmings having a chat at the Moat with Unknown offices in that there London. Enjoy the police sirens. They were great.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's been me on Twitter saying that I'm putting music out for the first time, which I'm finding deeply ironic.
Having worked in music for how long now?
I mean, there was a sort of 6-year layover period. I started at Sony Music in 97, and then I left the music business in about 2000, 2001, and then I went back in about 2008, and I've been in it ever since. But yeah, it was definitely, I think the re-entry was the point at like, yeah, I'm out. I'm not going to make music anymore.
I'm done.
I can't do both. If you're going to do it all day for work, you're not going to do it for pleasure afterwards. But I've just kind of revisited that, and it's been interesting, quite eye-opening to do. So yeah, so that's been my day on Twitter. It's been quite strange to sort of say, yeah, I know I'm the bloke that does the music marketing stuff, but actually now I'm swapping sides and I've made something, and it's going to be...
You're the enemy now. No, wait, that's wrong.
Well, I'm sort of curious because it is that thing of like you put the shoe on the other foot and suddenly it is a bit of a like, oh, this is what it looks like from this side of the fence. You know, when you're sat there going, I've made something, now what? Because I'm not an artist. Like, I work with artists who have already achieved. So they've got past the really hard bit, which is getting anyone to care about your work. And they've got to a point where plenty of people care. Enough people care that it's a business, you know.
Yeah,
and within that, I'm then involved.
Can they need someone to do your job?
Yeah, yeah. But the bit before that is the horror bit, isn't it? It's the kind of, you know, no one cares bit. And I now find myself on, like, day one. But just like, nobody cares. You know, and the production and everything else is probably pretty poor. But there's just this sort of...
Didn't stop me.
But, well, you know what? I mean, I've got to say, I mean, I've got to blame this guy Gino, who writes an amazing blog called Microchop that looks at how music is made with, you know, it's predominantly a hip-hop focus. And I was reading that last Christmas, and in that, it was this whole thing about how Dilla had made donuts in when he was in hospital with just a 404 sampler and a portable record player. And I was kind of like, Jesus, you know, if that's literally all he made it on, that is bonkers, you know, and it's now considered a seminal record, literally made by a guy in his hospital bed. And then I started reading other articles, and it just made me realise that in my head, of, you know, you kind of take this view of producers of being, you know, they're all just brilliant, you know, and they're all incredibly talented at tweaking sound and everything else. And then as you read more and more of his articles, you realise that most of them were just like the rest of us, in that they were sort of just bowling into it with an urge to create. And then in creating, they were kind of, you know, they weren't sat there spending 10 hours finessing the hi-hat.
Yeah.
It was just like, get this down, you know, get the vibe and get it out.
Mm.
And it just really inspired me. And I kind of reawakened this kind of, you know... It was like the boilers was just on the pilot light for 10 years of just like it was there, and it sort of manifests through passion for music in terms of my day job, and I'm very lucky to have a job where I, you know, work in music and all of that. I mean, pros and cons, which I'm sure we may come to, but you know, in working in music, it's nice, but the creative urge. Where you need to express yourself and you need to just make stuff had sort of gone to sleep. And it was like reading these, just sort of something like the boiler fired again. And it was like, hang on, I want to have another run at this. And then it turned out that a bunch of my mates had done the same thing, where they'd lapsed and, you know, life got in the way, jobs, family. And there's a few of us now are a bit like, oh, we want to do this.
Mm.
And it's not, I think the nice thing is now I'm at a point in my life where I'm, you know, I'm old, and so I don't need the validation that comes with when you're younger.
Yeah.
And that's even better, because I used to watch people that just played in pubs for a living. Well, not for a living, but just they were, their aspiration in music was just to play in a pub. And they were totally happy with that. And I was always a bit jealous that someone could just enjoy the moment of playing, and that was it. And there was no like thing where they were seeing it as like, well, you know, I'm playing in a pub and I might get spotted and I might get signed and I might get a deal and I might get more famous, and then da da da. I might be, you know, whoever.
It's YouTube. the one thing of like any form of art. As soon as it becomes like your job, as soon as it becomes commoditized in some way and you start relying on that income,
yeah,
it's really hard to keep the joy of doing part on top of the, you know, the actual trying to keep those two things separate at the same time as still earning money from it. So if you were approaching it from that point of view of this doesn't matter, isn't designed to pay my mortgage or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, or in my case, get me a mortgage in the first place, then you can be freer to create, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's just that thing of having that outlet. And it's a weird one, because as someone that runs a business that along the way, you know, just got kind of grossly over-involved with it and had an epic kind of burnout, you know, followed by 9 months of depression and, you know, really, really bleak headspace to be in, It's funny how going
are you
back
looking
to
forward
music...
to the rest of the podcast, listeners? We're going there. I've written down mental health. Don't worry, we'll get to it.
But having done that, it's, you know, you realise how much making music lifts you. You know, and it is just getting back to that thing of it. Just it's like I will put music out, but I'm totally fine if only five people play it.
Mm.
Like I'm not. I will never sit there and be like, oh, I can't believe I'm not the next whomever. You know, it's just. There's a joy in the process. It's a bit like that Buddhist thing of like, you know, it's the journey, not the destination sort of thing. And the only reason I'm putting stuff out is because I'm sat there being like, well, it just sort of feels like the logical end point. If you're going to make a song, and these days the irony is releasing a song is no longer a trial. You know, it doesn't require a ton of money.
No,
because you no longer have to get, you know, you don't have to pony up a grand to get X number of 7, 12 inches, whatever, made up, and then find a distributor and all that horror. You can literally go to DistroKid with 25 quid and
I think
be in the market.
One song, DistroKid's like $9.
Yeah, so it's you've got that kind of...
And it be on route. Like Spotify in 2 days.
Yeah.
You know.
It's amazing.
It's insane.
I mean, it's amazing. I think it's also a problem in the you know, it's that thing of like when, you know, when... It when it's limited and it's special because only a few people can do it, it carries value. But when everyone can do it, it's not so special anymore.
Yeah.
And there's a struggle there. But
so
maybe we'll come to that.
We will come to that. There's there's the phrase chronic abundance written there.
Yes.
This is the throwing forward. But what we haven't done is actually say what you do. How do you describe yourself to...
I run a company called Motive Unknown. We've been around for about 8 years, and I've always struggled with explaining what we do. I mean, a crass way of saying it, if I was trying to talk to someone in a business sense, is I suppose we're just a company of smart people who help artists make more money.
Mm.
And that was originally through digital marketing. So I started out doing marketing for all kinds of releases, including. One of yours, two of yours, actually.
Two of ours.
Yeah, albums two and three, where, you know, I had some involvement with. But increasingly, we're getting involved more with e-commerce and with just, helping artists find smarter ways to operate in a time where I guess we're, you know, I wouldn't go as far as to say we're post-label, but I think it's never been a better time to be an artist of a certain level. Because the power is very much coming back to them.
Yeah.
And they, you know, the smart artists can now take things on and exploit stuff. And I think perhaps if a criticism of music these days is, or a problem with it, is that it's one of a much greater volume of distractions in the world, because there are apps and there are games, and, you know, that those worlds are bigger and bigger and bigger than they ever were. You know, we're peeled back 30 years and it was like you had, you know, music and films was pretty much it.
So,
you know, for entertainment, that's what you did.
It was those paper block things. You could open them.
Yes. Yeah.
Like books?
Kindles. Remember those well.
And analog
books. But, you know, so now with all these things, it means, yes, there's a great number of distractions, but actually I think smart artists get involved in all of that as well and just look at it as like there's only... And, you know, and it's something I always say is like there's only, you know, an artist or a band and their fans and sort of everything in between is just sort of people almost getting in the way. And I'm aware that I am one of those people, but I suppose Motive Unknown tries to help artists maybe reduce the number of people that are involved.
Yeah.
And sort of taking from the
process. Because we sort of touched on this before we started. There was the campaign you first worked on for me and Pip was Logic for Chance, and it was a weird time for us because we'd gone from Angles being like the ragtag boys, independent, like, oh, we're just lucky to be here. And then we'd finished Logic for Chance and we went into this meeting and there was us two. And then there was like two people, digital marketing, a TV plugger, two different types of radio pluggers.
A whole squad.
And there was like, I think it was like 11, 12 people in that room about to market this thing I'd written in the spare bedroom.
Yeah.
You know? And it was like, what? And it is a really odd thing that I think a lot of music consumers listeners don't realise how many jobs a song creates.
Yeah.
Or especially then, I think that there are less people involved in a lot of campaigns now, which I personally think is a good thing.
Mm.
But, like, yeah, there's a period of time where even a band of me and Pip size, which was never huge,
yeah,
could be
supporting a ton of
supporting
people.
Yeah, like
it's sort of, it reminds me a bit, I think it was Buzz Aldrin, wasn't it, where someone said he was sat there once looking at the space, you know, the, whatever it was, Saturn V, that was going to take them up to the moon, and someone said, oh, what are you thinking, and his famous quote was something like, I'm thinking that everyone that built a part on that spaceship was the lowest bidder, you know, on the price to make it happen. And it's sort of a bit like that, I'd imagine, when you're an artist and you walk in the room and you see like 12 people, there must be a thing of like thinking, I'm wondering how much money's going to be left when all of these people have been paid, because everyone's getting a bit.
I always found it funny as well, was that with using space analogies, it's like, and NASA always had like a 1% failure rate on parts on the space shuttle. Their optimum was 1%. And it's like, okay, how many parts is that? Oh, it's about 2,500.
Yeah.
2,500 parts failing. It's like, and that's good?
It's like, that's a bonus.
But that always felt like the music industry to me. Like, no matter how much work the artist put in, like, all the failures along the way seem to be accounted for.
Mm.
And instead of, it seemed to be expected.
Yeah.
Rather than accounted for, is what I mean. Yeah. It's like they, instead of saying, well, let's not make that mistake, it's like, well, that might happen. Like, well, let's fix that. Let's not do that.
Yeah, try not to let it happen. I mean, it was something I liked about being predominantly, you know, when I returned to the music business, like 2008, 2009, it was in the indie side. And it always felt like, at least on the indie side, there wasn't just that sense of like, the throw 10 things at the wall and just kind of pray that one of them recoups enough to cover the hit of the other nine kind of failing. And in indie, there just wasn't the room. You know, you couldn't have a record be a horrific failure. You know, there would be accountability.
Mm.
You couldn't just sort of be like, meh, move on, you know, next. It didn't work like that. So, and I think it's been great because it does sort of still inform my view now of like, well, no, you can't just kind of, you know, spaff $3,000 on stuff that might work. It's like, is it going to work or not?
Yeah.
You know, we've got to try really, really hard because this is people's money we're spending. And at every point, we've got to understand that.
Mm.
And, you know, we've done a lot around that of boring stuff within the business to just, you know, it's great to hit a point where around e-commerce, you know, with any of our clients. But, you know, first of all, it was with Run the Jewels to just go, right, you know, we've spent this much on ads.
Mm.
But we've made you this much back. So there was an absolutely black and white.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you spent whatever, you know, $100, for example, and you got, you know, $1,000 back, then it was like, and there's no then vague conversation. It was sort of like, fine, we'll just carry on spending, you know, because it's making money. And we all knew where we were. So it's like, it's quite refreshing after working in recorded music only, where, I mean, to this day, you know, we've had artists where we've talked about doing percentage deals, but we've kind of sat there thinking, well, a percentage of what?
Yeah.
But by the time everyone's chipped away all their stuff, I don't even know what I'm getting a percentage of.
Yeah.
So it's just such a liability. We can't do those kinds of deals.
It's
terrible.
I've obviously always been very open about the money side of things on social media and stuff. And like, people don't realise that even a truly independent band, if they say they're touring, there's still a lot of places that money has to go.
Yeah.
Even a band who has no label, they've still probably got someone driving the van. Oh, and they're still renting that van. And they're douche, and it, all those things that the song, the performance, they're being paid for, they get chipped away to the extent that even with me and Pip being only two people, we were, throughout our career, the minority, the lowest amount of money made from our music.
Yeah.
And to me, that is an industry that doesn't have an end game.
Yeah.
Because if the people who create your technically only product are the ones who can't survive on it,
yeah,
you're not building toward a future. But yeah. The problem is that's how capitalism works. And,
well, it is, and it's. I think unfortunately, it's like it speaks. You know, there's an overlap to the things like the well-being problem in the music industry, which is that there's a sort of sense that, you know, once we're done with you, there's another 100 queuing around the block to get in the door. So there's a sort of transience of like, well, we don't care if we chew you up and spit you out because we've got others. You know, you're replaceable.
The mental health thing with all creators, you're going to have a peak. There's always going to be a place where you are the biggest you're ever going to be.
Mm.
And it is really interesting when you talk to artists after that peak.
Yeah.
Because there's no... I'm not saying that there should be a support network for bands post their peak.
Yeah, yeah.
But no one talks about the fact that you are going to feel loss. You are going to feel lost as well.
Yeah.
In that. And you see it. There's plenty of artists who've had that peak and then are still working away. And you just see that their tone online becomes more and more negative and more defeated by the industry.
Yeah.
And genuinely, a lot of people, if we were more careful with artists on the way in, these are the possibilities, but this is the reality.
Yeah, yeah.
We might be doing the industry more of a service. But that also applies to labels. That also applies to the people in the industry, because there's so many people who burn out and end up leaving. So much talent that leaves any creative industry because of working 17-hour days to get jobs done. You know, people...
Yeah, well, there's a sort of consistent thing I've seen of people just going, do you know what? I no longer seek the validation of music. You know, I don't need to be in music, and I know I can earn a lot more money not being in music, because music just doesn't pay that well compared to, you know, in certain spheres, you know, there's definitely, my world, kind of online marketing and things like that is one of them, you know, where if you go and do that in a multitude of other industries, you'd be on two or three times what you earn in music. So it's quite common to see. You remember, you know, I mean, when I started again in music in about 2009 doing digital properly, you know, you had people like Ian Rogers at Topspin, who was quite a sort of bit of a rock star kind of developer marketing guy.
Topspin are kind of hard to describe what they did to like a layman, but they kind of handled the direct to consumer.
Yeah, they were like all the direct to fan sort of structure that an artist would need. So they kind of allowed e-commerce, but they gave you a mailing list management system and stuff like that.
And they kind of integrated with Facebook as well.
Yeah, they did all sorts of stuff. You remember they used to do the email for media, you know, so get your email and we'll send you a track and stuff like that. And Ian kind of co-founded that. And there was another guy whose name escapes me. Oh, Ethan Kaplan was another one who was, again, quite a sort of visionary digital guy. And yeah, kind of fast forward a little while, you know, and Ian jumped ship to go to LVMH in Paris, so kind of went all the way across and was suddenly at Louis Vuitton and all them. And I think Ethan went to Fender, so sort of still music, but not music industry. Not
but definitely
music.
a different
world. Yeah. And it was just, there was a period where it just felt there was a real brain drain of the smart people just going, do you know what? This is just bollocks. You know, I'm done. I can't be bothered.
The thing about that brain drain, we can, like, Apple and HMV. HMV's demise over the long term can actually be traced to Apple launching.
Mm.
Because Apple, when they started, once they'd opened Regent Street, they just gutted HMV of management.
Mm.
They took graduate managers, but they wouldn't take head office, they wouldn't take regional managers. They took the people who worked on a shop floor for a number of years, and literally, if go to any Apple store, and you will find at least one, two people who came from HMV.
Wow.
And you can see that HMV struggled. They had centralized buying because they didn't have the talent in stores to manage that, so like buying became irrelevant. If you had a big jungle scene, you didn't have any jungle in your store because whoever at head office.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is when an industry loses all that talent, it might not happen immediately, but it hurts in the long run.
It's a, you know, I mean, all those things, I think, and they just set that weird precedent where, you know, if a bunch of people in a 6 month period all exit the music industry for posh jobs elsewhere, it looks like a viable career move for anyone else on the rise, you know, on the way up, because they're kind of thinking, oh, I'll just get to this point and then pivot out to luxury brand or, you know, film company or any of those sorts of things. And I can't really blame them. Like, you know, it's an interesting, you know, it's been funny for me. Like, I only started Motive Unknown as just out of a sense of frustration at the time of looking around thinking, oh, there's all this cool stuff going on, like stuff like Top Spin, and it was a sort of emergence of that thing of, you know, maybe artists can be quite empowered and do cool things that really put the fan first and ask what they want. And it's kind of easy to forget. I mean, even now there's this thing of, like, you know, labels are dictating what they want to do because the label is serving its interests, not the fans. You know, it's all about what it can get, and it's just not, you know, it's not, it isn't looking at the fan first and going, well, what they want. They're going, well, this is what we need. And fuck it, we'll just make that work. But, you know, that emergence of Topspin and all those things, you know, it caused me to start my company, and it was basically a one-man outfit, you know, left. First client was Alt J, so I kind of landed a winner in it. That happened, and that led to a lot of other work. But it was interesting in that
sense.
You've
done a lot, you know, like you say, Old J, but then you've done stuff with Blink-182, J Dilla, who else did I write down? Slade. I had to write down Slade.
Yeah, yeah. The award-winning box set with Slade.
Yeah.
I mean, we've done a... I mean, you know, I think with all these things, I'm always a bit wary of, you know, tacking your name on the stuff. You know, I'm very proud of what I achieved with Alt J as part of that team. And I'm continue to be really proud of what I do with Run the Jewels. And I think actually
you came in at Run the Jewels in the second album.
Yeah, it was partway into Run the Jewels 2. And it's a funny story, right? I've never told anyone this, and even the band and management don't know. But at the point when Run the Jewels phoned me up, I was struggling in a really bad place with depression. And work had just broken me. And I think when you run your own business, you know, it's your thing, and you know, it's only your thing. So you're kind of always on, because there's, you know, to not be always on is to sort of potentially fail. So that was my view. It was like, I have to work around the clock, and was sort of entirely unaware of mental health, full stop. You know, just didn't occur to me that was a thing. Well, not that it was a thing, obviously it's a thing, but I never once felt like it could happen to
me. There's that point in depression that you know you feel like shit.
Yeah.
But you don't realise that there's another way to feel.
Yeah, like, I mean...
This is just life.
I think the worry for me was when I stopped feeling anything. And that was when I was like, fuck, this is really bad.
Yeah.
And it was like a light had gone out. And I was just... absolutely at the bottom of the it was horrible, because, you know, on the face of it, nothing was wrong. I hadn't lost anyone, I hadn't split up, I was still, you know, I've been in a relationship for 21 years soon. You know, I've got a 12-year-old son now. Everything in that sense was fine, but I just completely overcooked my capacity for my head, you know. And burned out. So I was kind of struggling quite a lot with that, and I had a kind of moment where it was almost like, you know, your subconscious clawing back, and it was very much sitting there to say, you know, if you know to get out of this, you've got to fight for things you love, and you've got to really do that. But the music that sort of soundtracked that fight was Run the Jewels 2.
Yeah.
Because it's very adrenalized. It's very just like, come on, you know. Yeah. And it was sort of, it was the album that literally was, it was like it was kicking me up the arse to climb out of the trench.
Yeah.
You know, and get out of it.
It's funny because, like, I've always heard a bit of LP on the Run the Jewels record saying, fuck you. Like a little bit of, like, obviously, that guy's worked, you know, and he's had many stages to his career. He ran Def Jux as well, which is the one of the labels that got me into hip hop, and you know, that alongside Big Dada were really important labels to me. And then obviously, Run the Jewels seemed like, oh, LP hasn't just retired.
Yeah,
I'm not saying, you know what I mean, but it definitely felt like he was like, I'm done, I've done what I can.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was like, actually, no, fuck you guys, I've got something massive
to prove,
you know, which is awesome, you know.
Yeah, and it was, I mean, you know, and it was a revelation for me, and you know, and so it was just really bizarre. I mean, it was literally, I was clawing myself out of a hole whilst trying to keep the business running and all of that. And then got a phone call from a lady called Zena, who at the time ran a company in, she was then in London, she now runs Partisan in New York, but she was over here, and she, you know, her business kind of represented Run the Jewels for Europe.
Mm.
And she just kind of said, look, you know, would you like to get involved? And I mean, I would have taken it for free, you know, because I was just like,
that.
It was that thing of, you know, I mean, there's music I like. So, you know, when Mass Appeal said, you want to work on this sort of posthumous Jay Dilla release, it was just like, yeah, of course I do.
Yeah.
You know, and like, I think we might be getting involved with Madlib and Freddie Gibbs soon. And that's another one where I'm like, Jesus, you know, yeah, of course. Amazing. But Run the Jewels 2 is a truly special record for me because, you know, it was a big, big turning point in my life, from like being at the lowest point to climbing out of it and seeing a point on the horizon. So it was sort of ironic because it was the music that dug me out of the hole. But then arguably it was the work with Run the Jewels that sort of accelerated my kind of climb back, because equally, that, you know, they are a team that make me bring my A game. You know, I think when you're involved in any team, the team is either kind of super conducive to you as a person and as a creative individual trying to find solutions, or it isn't, and it's stifling and it's rather sort of irritating and depressing to work on. Not, you know, it just drags you down, draws the life out of it a bit, you know, where you're like, we've got this idea, and someone, you know,
don't give a fuck.
Yeah, it's like, oh, but what about this? And you, all your energy is like sapping out of it. Whereas with Run the Jewels, it's the opposite way round. And,
so before the music, I worked in the global communications for Ernst & Young.
Mm.
And that corporate environment, like, mind-melting. We had this little team of communicators who had to express things, but it was all internal. It was all about expressing things to the rest of Ernst & Young. And just the level of depression in that team, because no matter how bland an idea, it would be just crushed, because the people who ran that company were accountants.
But I mean, do you think it's like, it's a thing like, so, you know, when I left uni, I've always been good with computers. So I taught a friend to use a PC. I was off at uni in Brighton learning, bizarrely, doing a course in ostensibly how to be a librarian.
Nice.
But I mean, it's great. My dissertation, they said, oh, you can either write a dissertation, which is like millions of words, or do a project. And I was like, what's a project? And they said, well, you can basically make something and write about it. And I was like, right, well, I'm in on that, because that sounds way easier. Went to my local record shop and said, if I build you a website with a shop, and this is, bearing in mind, this is like 1994 or 5, you know, very early days.
What record shop?
It was a shop called Woodstock Records in St. Albans.
Mm.
And I said, I'll do it for £500 in vinyl. And he was like, brilliant, because obviously for him it's wholesale. So it's he was benefiting. And I got 2-1. But I left, and there was no use for that at all. And my mate, in the meantime, who I'd literally just shown him how a PC works, he was working on the trading floor at the Stock Exchange doing IT support. Because that was the way it was then. And he was like on £60,000 a year, and he was like, yeah, I'm rich. You know, contractors and all that. So he said, oh, you've got to come and do this. So I said, all right. So I went off and worked at banks, and it was the same thing of, you're just sitting there looking around going, this can't be it. This can't be life. And every day I would sit on the train, and I remember listening to things like Introducing by DJ Shadow or kind of OK Computer and stuff like that, all the way into the city, and just thinking, fuck.
Yeah.
It's like I can feel my life just ebbing away. and it can't be this fucking bad, you know?
Yeah.
And then it was just the strangest thing, because I was doing IT support. I wound up working at Revlon, because I just went back to, it was when you were a contractor. Back to the contractor, but he was like, please never put me in a financial thing, I work anywhere. And they went, Revlon? And I was like, makeup, models, I'm in. So in I went. And then after that, I was like, you know what? I love music. I'd love to work in the music business. And I know that makes me sound like a twat, because I'm sure everyone says this. And the bloke was like, yeah, fair enough. And then he just rang me up and said, yeah, we thought of you, because Sony Music needs someone. And I was like, fuck, you know, I'm in. And I got the job. And that was how I got into the music business, you know. But yeah, there was definitely a thing of just sitting there at some point, looking around, feeling like, you know, no one else speaks your language. Mm. And everyone in the bank's being like, yeah, no, I'm going to get another Merc, or I'm going to get Beamer.
Yeah.
And I'm sat there, and I was probably earning more money then than I've ever earned since. And I was just sat looking around going, Jesus Christ, this can't be it, can it?
Yeah.
When you leave uni, it's like, is this the rest of my life? This is awful.
The thing I found really funny was, like, when I told people I was going to leave Ernst & Young and do the music thing, they looked at me like I was some sort of idiot.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Well, which you can't relate.
You got a job for however long, you know, like, that was a long-term job. Like, I could have had a house by now. I could own property by now if I'd stayed there. But it's like, yeah, but I'm fucking sad. I walk across the London Bridge every day, and I want to jump off it.
But I think it's. I remember having this conversation with a few friends of mine, where it was like, "Is it a curse to be creative? Because your urge to create is so strong that it you know, it definitely guides your worldview. You know, and for me, and I dare say you, given your background, it's like, you know, music sort of pumps through your blood, and it's just a, you know, take the music away from you, and you're half a person is left, sort of thing. And it's almost like a curse, because you can't not do it. And that was the thing for me, was like, I couldn't imagine any world where I wasn't around music.
Yeah.
And which is why, you know, it was great to follow that path and, you know, and do all that stuff. And now it's great because I still, you know, I'm a fan first and foremost. And I'm sort of, it's like in the work with RTJ, I'm quite well known for being the fan on the team.
Mm.
You know, so I speak as a fan. And I, you know, if I don't like stuff, it's because I'm a fan. And, you know, so when there's merch, I'm sat there. And if it's like, I wouldn't wear it, and this is why.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm saying it as a fan, not as, you know, someone with a chip on the
shoulder. I think you can see it with bands who have people around them who actually care.
Yeah.
You know, who aren't going to make... I'm going to let that band make a not dumb decision, but compromise on something that could be done better, you know. And it's important to.
Well, it's something I remember. We were on a call once with LP, and he said something which has sort of defined how I view Run the Jewels ever since. Where he was saying, you know, you can be the better person and still make a good living.
Mm.
Like, in order to be successful, you don't have to, like, crush all those in front of you.
You can,
and it's like, even the way I run Motive Unknown, like, now it's growing, you know, and soon there's going to be 9 of us, and it's like, you know, we have a profit share. So if we have a bumper year and we've done really well, everyone benefits, you know, and I want, having worked in a lot of businesses that use and abuse staff to hire them, and just like, you're there, you will do that job, and I don't really give a shit about your career path or what you're doing. You're just, that's the job you're paid to do, and then if you get bored of it and you want to go and do something else,
we'll
fine.
Just get someone
else. See you later, we'll replace you. My view is that my staff are very dear to me, and I would kind of, if I can have, you know, zero staff turnover because my staff continue to grow and develop and kind of show me what they've got, you know, bring their best work and enjoy it and all those things, then I'm doing it right. So within the company, there's very much of a thing of, you know, and again, there's the well-being thing of, like, you know, given what happened to me and my company's grown after that, you know, I believe quite strongly that those things come from the top down. So I do try and you know, instill a culture here. Like, no, we don't work weekends and we don't do 15-hour days. You know, that's not... Yeah. A norm that I want to set, and it's partly because our job involves us being, you know, clear thinking, creative people.
Yeah,
and you can't do that when you're burdened with, you know, I've got 5 million things on my head, and I'm sort of buckling under the weight of it. that's not when you have your best ideas.
No.
So we have to think clearly, and it's sort of, it's working at the moment. You know, I haven't had anyone leave who's joined yet. I've had one person, but that was fine. That was, you know, it was good in the way that he went, and
yeah.
It remains dear to us and everything else. So in that sense of, like, I guess in the phase two of Motive Unknown, after I kind of bounce back, if you like, Alan Partridge style, it's been a good team, and it works well.
It's something that the music industry, very few creative industries, talk about with crunch, as they call it in games, crunch. This has to happen, and we don't care about the human cost of it.
Okay.
You know, games companies, like the people running Fortnite, they're running 80, 90 hour weeks. People are sleeping on the floor, and, you know, this is not the way to run a business. But what I find is that so few industries are willing to actually talk openly about it as well.
Yeah.
Because everyone's guilty of it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like every company has forced staff to stay on later. Even self-employed people have forced themselves to stay on later. But I don't know where that comes from. I don't know why we've got ourselves in this situation, especially in creative industries where a lot of people are self-sufficient, that we're forcing ourselves to, like, kill ourselves, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it does puzzle me, because there's two sides to approach it from. One is that it's kind of like, you know, it's wrong, and you shouldn't treat people that way, you know, and it's rooted in a sort of critical, negative standpoint of going, you know, this is not right, this is bad, and you should not be doing it, and all, you know, terms like that. But I think the perversity is that there's a much simpler truth, which is that I just think happier people do better work.
Mm.
And in my job, you know, where we have to try and find better ways of doing things and all that sort of stuff, you know, they're not gonna work well if they're drowning in, you know, under the weight of expectation and you know, a sense that they should be doing 15-hour days and all that shit. You know, I don't buy into that. I mean, maybe it's a greed thing. Is there a sense of, like, you know, unless I'm earning 300 grand a year, then this is not working as a venture? Yeah. And it's like, I don't buy into that. You know?
Well, there's a difference between wanting some of the money and wanting all of the money.
Yeah.
And the companies that I've always gravitated to or respected are the companies that just want some of it. They just want a fair share. Rather than you know.
But again, it's back to that thing of you know, said, you know, Elle's kind of quote, you know, you can be the better person without, you know, and be successful. And I think it's, you know, he said that kind of, that was last December when he mentioned that. And I've been running Motive Unknown with the philosophy we stick to now for some time then. So it wasn't like Elle's words kind of changed the way we operate, but it was an interesting kind of validation, I suppose, of like, yeah, and that's how I view it too. And, it, you know, in a weird way, it's quite nice, because it's sort of an affirmation that, you know, you're working with the right people.
Yeah.
You know, and there's just that sense of humanity about what they're doing. And, you know, and I like that. And I think, you know, within the way this business operates, it's kind of like, I keep saying to my guys lately, it's like there are allies of ours, and there's definitely people that are not allies, you know. And it's not like they're enemies, but there's just, we have, you know, among our clients, you know, 90% of them they share our sort of worldview, and we really click and we work really well together because there's just a mutual respect and all these kinds of things. I mean, it's interesting in that one thing I never thought that we would get into in a weird way is just the, you know, how we all work. And it's something the music industry is awful at. It's like, how do we work? How do we communicate?
Yeah.
How do we structure? And how do we do this? And we spend a weirdly large amount of time trying to figure that out. Mm. Like, you know, if there's a bunch of mundane, boring tasks, can we find something to make them go away? And I always kind of say, if your job is like a triangle shape, you know, the sort of bottom third is that thick bit of the triangle, and it's usually just shite.
Yeah.
Just boring admin stuff, you know. It's like now I'm an MD of a company of 9 people. I do a surprising, you know, I don't have an HR manager or an office manager. So, you know, I'm sat there doing payroll, ordering chairs, you know, because someone's got to do it. But it's those things where you're sort of looking at going, oh, okay, well, can I just find something that makes this go away?
Mike Bithell, the game developer, who was episode 1 of this podcast, they've just announced the John Wick game.
Right.
It's really funny because he's, even though he is writing the John Wick game, so he has to get this script approved by Lionsgate and all this, he still sees his most important job at his company is to know when to order pizza for everyone else. Like, that's still to him, like, his role is, I have to make sure that these people who are working are happy, even though he's a massive responsibility.
Yeah.
And,
it's the sort of thing of, like, from, you know, it's the seed, isn't it? If the seed is the pizza that makes the good ideas come forth happy, you know, I was going to say healthy, probably not with pizza, but you know what I mean? They're kind of well looked after. And it is that. And I think, you know, with us, it's surprising the number of clients where part of our work has almost turned into almost like a consultancy as to how to work better.
Yeah, yeah.
How to just communicate better. And it's not the sexiest topic, you know what I mean? How can we work together better? But it's what takes a lot of that shit out of your day so that we can all get more done. And our view was always, like, there was an article that I remember sending to Tom, this was like 3 years ago, about a guy that makes surfboards in America who decided to try and cut his work day for him and he had about 10 staff to reduce it to
5 hours, was it?
Yeah, something like that. And they finish like 2 PM and then go surfing.
Mm.
And he kind of put time into this. It wasn't like hey, everyone, let's just knock off at 2.
Yeah, we'll just...
He was like, right, if we're going to do like a 9 till 2 day, there's no lunch break, there's no coffee breaks, I don't want any small talk. It's like we've got to come in and kind of hit it pretty hard.
Yeah.
But then we can do all the small talk and bullshit at 2 o'clock when we all go surfing for 3 hours or whatever.
Yeah.
And his productivity doubled, you know, because they just spent time figuring out how to make that work and get where they want to go. And me and Tom, like, we're a service business, so I guess we can't dictate our hours to quite the same extent. But there's always been this thing in our head of, like, if we can do the same job and not have to work an 8-hour day, we're totally fine with that. You know, it's like, there's not that sense of, like, gravid kind of, must work. It's like, no, you know, these days, if I can do no work and spend the day going back to making music and doing things that really kind of bring me, you know, a lot of pleasure and relaxation and joy, then I'm completely at ease with that.
And yeah, like, and feeling like your free time is well spent makes it easier to go and do your commitment time.
You've got to have that. And I think it took me a long time to learn that for me, relaxation isn't something that happens when I'm not working. It's not like if I'm not working, I'm relaxing. The truth is, if I'm not working, I might be watching TV thinking about work, or I might be walking thinking about work. So I kind of realised a couple of years ago that I needed to sort of proactively relax.
Yeah.
So now I, you know,
I'm actively relax.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's like, you know, I'm addicted to Assassin's Creed, which I think you've already heard about at some length. You know, so I'll do that because it love that. But
which
I'm
is
winding
funny,
with serious murder.
Open world video games are day jobs. In their weird way there, because you have a list of tasks, I've got to go this, I've got to go to this place. But, like, if you are someone who is a workaholic as such, some people would say, well, it's bad that you're still technically working. It's like, well, no, maybe that just fulfills that need in me to tick off a checklist,
but
I'm still running around having fun, jumping on my horse, stabbing that guy, and
well, for me, it's
do you play as the woman or the man?
The man.
Oh, unlucky, man.
Yeah.
Unlucky. Oh, I couldn't do it.
Don't say that.
Couldn't do it.
I checked my hours, actually, the other day, just out of curiosity. I've done 175 hours.
Wow.
I'm like, it's a definite point where I feel like I should reflect on my choices in life. But I don't care, because it's just, it's really important with your head to disconnect. And for me, you know, I think it's not something I've considered, really, where it's a structured game, you know, it is a thing of, you know.
Talk to me when you have 2,000 hours in the game.
But it is that thing, isn't it, of, like, I've done a thing and you get the reward of completion and you've cleared a camp or whatever.
It's actually why there's a Destiny and Destiny 2.
Yeah.
Destiny 1 I have 2,000 odd hours in.
Bloody hell.
Destiny 2 I have 300.
Right.
And I, because I realised that it was fulfilling that need to get things done too well.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the way they lay out, because Destiny is designed as a live service as well, which is ugh, but it deliberately has things that reset each day or each week.
Got it.
And then it has seasons, so new content.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's got this constant churn of a to-do list. And it's why? Why am I doing this? You know? And I realized as soon as I stopped that game, I was more productive. Weirdly, I still play another game I've got 2,000 hours in, a game called The Binding of Isaac, but that doesn't have that checklist thing.
Yeah,
I've unlocked everything I'm ever going to unlock. I have no thing I have to do in that game. The only reason I'm playing it is because I want to.
Yeah.
Weirdly, I use that when I'm listening to podcasts or doing research for this. Anything I have to listen to, it's just nice to be doing something.
Yeah,
just, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, I get that. I mean, you know, same with me. When I'm listening to music, I tend to be out and about
more
these days. I don't. It's pretty rare that I'll just sit and listen to music and not be doing something else.
Passive listening.
Yeah,
is something I do more than active. Yeah. Obviously, music. Although I don't earn a living from music in any way, music still I still consider it my job.
Yeah.
It's still my craft, so
yeah, yeah.
I actively listen to things when people want me to, or when I am doing something commissioned or whatever.
But yeah, so I mean, it's you know, it's a funny one for me. I just find that you know those things that help you relax. I mean, and I think it's the same with making music. You know, I've been, you know, just learning that all again. And it's been great. You know, but again, it's something that requires a sufficient amount of concentration to take me away from the day job,
yeah,
and that sort of stuff, and it is that thing of like the disconnection then allows you to come back with fresh ideas, and it's amazing how you have to clear space for the sort of subconscious side of your creative personality to bubble up. And it's been weird, you know. It's like I was playing Assassin's Creed and the new DLC, the Fate of Atlantis, came out, and I was sort of sitting there thinking, oh, this is quite good value, because at the time I bought not the really expensive version,
yeah,
maybe the, not deluxe, but whatever the gold version was or something, that came with all the season stuff. And at the time it was about £75. And I thought, you know what, don't mind, I'm going to spring for this. But the more DLC they release that I've paid for up front, I'm like, this is better and better value. But it kind of got me sat there and looking at it. And in the end, I was, you know, I was sat there thinking, I wonder if you can do like a season pass for an album. Like, what if Run the Jewels put an album out where it was like, here's the album, but for a little bit more, you can have two T-shirts, you know, over the next 6 to 9 months.
Yeah.
Or we'll give you the next EP on vinyl or something. So there's a sort of thing there.
I'm just scared of, like, any other creative industry using the games industry's bleeding edge.
Well, I think you're always looking at this stuff, though, and just thinking, are there different ways of doing it. I mean, I think it was because I was looking at it thinking, actually, pound for pound, this has been really good value.
Yeah.
You know, the game was £75 and I've spent £175.
But the weird thing is, that value, it is, there's some odd little things that happen with that, because it changes. There's a lot of companies who are making those, I call them nebulous open world collectathons, because that's what that is. And,
yeah, yeah.
And it's a really enjoyable one. And it, the environment, it's worth the time.
It's like tourism, isn't it? Wandering around ancient Greece.
Yeah. But that does encourage games to change. Instead of, we don't get very many 10-hour narrative experiences anymore. Very few.
Yeah.
Whereas some of the greatest games of all time are those experiences.
Yeah.
And so it's how that quest for that value, but really that value is trying to get more money out of you, the consumer. Instead of paying 60, you spent 80 or 90.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, how that changes the industry, but also how it changes the audience. Because now, if an indie developer comes along and makes a 15-hour experience that's £20... people are like, oh yeah, that's not great value.
Pounds per hour.
You know, whereas, yeah, thinking of, no movie is judged on the length.
Yeah, yeah.
We judge it on the emotional engagement.
Yeah, know? I mean, it's a funny one. It bears a sort of weird thing to... I wrote this piece recently about why I feel streaming services are... I mean, I used the term gaslighting, which... I was deliberately being a bit baity with that.
Yes.
But are kind of selling us on this thing that is sort of fundamentally not,
yeah, this
not
is
true.
We've led naturally. I didn't have to segue or anything. This
yeah, well,
good.
No, and the reason I say it is because I kind of realised that I needed, you know, there's no way of saying, I feel like in British culture you can't say it, so it sounds like a massive prick, but it's like, I've done all right. Like, Motive and I was doing all right.
Yeah.
You know, I'm comfortable financially. I'm
yeah.
not rich, but I'm good. So I can afford to spend money.
Every
yeah.
now and again.
Yeah. You know, yeah. all that. But it's kind of like I can afford to spend money on things. And I just hit this thing of like, I feel like morally I should patronise in the literal sense artists by giving them money for the music I love.
Mm.
So it took me back to things like Bandcamp and like just, you know, the world I came up through was that world of underground, you know, beat producers and all that stuff. I did a radio show for years that, you know, brought in that whole area of, you know, of kind of that point where sort of hip hop stopped and electronic indie music type stuff started. And there was always gap in the middle with Prefuse 73 and Machine Drum and Spectre and all these kinds of people. And that was my world. And I kind of went back to picking through that in 2019 and thinking, actually, number, you know, I want to give them whatever, seven, eight, 9 quid, because I know that doing it on Bandcamp actually makes a difference to them. And aside from the validation thing of like someone's paid the money, you know, I like the idea that for every £10 I'm paying someone on Bandcamp, they're probably keeping sort of, I don't know, after deduction six fifty, something like that, 7 quid.
That's yeah,
15%, isn't it? In a PayPal.
Yeah, it's a PayPal take. Like, let's not get into that.
But bottom line
it's actually closer to 8.
Yeah, so they keep a lot more than they would via any other means. And so and now I've sort of got this thing of like, if I've spent money on it, which I know it's not it's a flawed logic. And I was criticised for this in the article, but it does make me invest into it. It's like if I've had to part with money, I will spend more time appreciating the thing I've spent money on.
Part of that, though, I think, is our age.
Oh, I'm sure,
because
yeah.
we never had, like, when I walked in, if I wanted a Batcat album, so an out of like when I bought Joy Division Unknown Pleasures from the Virgin Megastore, it cost me $16.50.
Right,
that was at the time, you know, where that's for a 40-minute album, you know, that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I was already on my way to Joy Division fandom, but I put more hours into that record because I didn't have this vast selection of other stuff because I just spent all my money on that. And B, I felt like I owed myself that time with that record. Whereas now, if you can have everything for free, maybe you don't quite see the value, you know? And which is one of the scary things with Spotify, and why I agree that you should have used the word gaslighting in that, because they've done more to change the perception of the value of music than, say, Pirate Bay ever did.
Yeah. They sort of, you know, and there's this thing of, you know, people will discover the music and they'll spend money on it elsewhere. And I mean, yeah, maybe. I just think it's the sort of narrative that, you know, that's that mechanism they've set up with this kind of abundance of everything is a great way to discover new music, because the way in which you discover it is, you know, I think it's really only coming to light now just how, you know, it's turning into just casual streaming. And you're seeing this with artists who've now, you know, come up through Spotify's playlists and are having, you know, they'll have 500 million streams, and yet, you know, we'll probably struggle to sell out a 500 cap venue.
B Dolan was talking to me about SoundCloud rappers and the amount of them who have tens of millions of listens, yet they'll come to New York and they can't sell a 200 cap room.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we're not as engaged, we're not as invested in that. Mm. It's like, oh, that's a good song. But, you know, having
to... doesn't
mean
anything. It doesn't move you.
In the article, you use the analogy of going into a record shop and instead of the guy behind the counter recommending one or two things, 20 people will come out and fill up your car with every record that ever existed.
Yeah.
And something that I realized was that the guy in the record shop, for me personally, often got it wrong.
Yeah.
And that was good.
Yeah.
Like, the algorithm... it's just pairing me with other I think they're called rational agents, is the algorithm for, right. If you like this, you'll like this. Because it's based on...
it's a sequential sort of...
however many other people like the same things as you, and it's the 5% difference trying to show you. And but when the guy in the record shop gets it wrong, it's because it's what he perceives in that band you love.
Yeah.
And that usually, those mistakes are the things that usually led on to like, oh wow, no, this is fucking
It's
rad.
Like a happy accident.
Yeah. Whereas the algorithm doesn't make that mistake.
No.
It just dumb, like, and it's very frustrating because not only are you, as an artist, having to fight the algorithm to get heard in the first place, or the Facebook algorithms to get seen, or for anyone to know you exist.
Then
to realise that if you're not a carbon copy of another band, then the listener's not going to hear you. My problem with Spotify is there's no encouragement to progress, like to push things forward, to make something new.
Yeah.
Because the algorithm is so dumb. It is so just blunt. But also, there's no encouragement to even make an album because of the way...
yeah,
because
they prioritise playlists.
They prioritise playlists, so it was 63 days for me when I look at the stats on Spotify for artists, because they care, One track, the track that got pushed to the discovery and all that, has 10 times the listens as other
anything
tracks.
Anything else, yeah.
Yet... you know, those tracks towards the tail of the album are some of the best on there because I crafted an album.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like, well, there was no point.
Yeah.
If we're in Spotify terms. So.
No, and that's the annoying thing. I mean, you know, it's equally for me, it's such a cold interface of like, you know, artist name and track title. And no, there's no story.
Mm.
You know, it makes me feel like an old fart sort of saying it, but it was that thing of like, you'd pull out the artwork, you know, you pull out a 12-inch and just be like, fucking hell.
Yeah, yeah.
What's going on there? And you look on the back and be like, all right, who produced this? You know, who's in the band? What are they saying? What's the weird shit written on the inside of the...
yeah, I want...
you know, on the record and all that.
I want the rumour. I want the weird stories that go... you know, I remember... Moldy Peaches, when Who's Got the Crack came out on 7.
Yeah.
My mate Mike was, like, really excited. And I was like, all right, what is this? It's like... I don't know. I just heard about it. One of them wears a Spider-Man suit. Mm. That was it. And then we were off. We were like, okay, I need to hear this record now. Dumb reasons. And then it turned out that first Moldy Peaches album was an amazing record. Kimmy Dawson is hilarious. And you know, but you don't get that in social media in general now with crafting. Like... so I tweeted today about mental health. Obviously, I've been in and out of I don't know what the word is, therapy and stuff for just over 20 years.
Right.
And I don't know how to talk about it on social media.
Yeah.
But what I couldn't express is the reason I don't know how to talk about it is because I can't honestly talk about it because of likes and retweets and all that. Like, I'm having to compress it down into one tweet because I don't want any part of it taken out of context. And if we're changing the way we talk as artists, but we're also changing the ways we create because Spotify, only one track matters on an album, it makes me very nervous about what it is to be a creator going forward.
Yeah.
You know.
But that's where I like that with some of our clients, you know, there's a sort of rejection of that concept.
Mm.
I'm a big fan of this notion that, like, you know, I mean, it's something that we're pushing quite a lot now within the company, is this sort of sense of, like, just ignore everything that's out there. Don't, because there's so much of this, like, I'm doing it because that's how it's always been done. And it's a sort of,
yeah,
I don't really care for that.
We don't have to follow those that came before us.
Yeah, well, you just look at what, you know, like I said, there's only the band and the fans. And it's like, you know, just because Spotify is there and might be the biggest thing at the minute, it doesn't mean that you have to rely on it and pander to it. So you know, we worked with Moby.
Yeah.
Moby had made his second album called Long Ambience 2 of very long ambient tracks. Well titled. You know, and each song is about 40 minutes long, so it's, you know, it's quite a big release in terms of duration. And we were looking at that and we're kind of like, you know, this stuff, I mean, Spotify puts you know, a lot of production music on these sorts of ambient playlists. There's been a bit of drama about that as to, you know, they're sort of filling out with sort of mook music that they've
so
just got off the
production
shelf.
Music, for those who don't know, are essentially tracks that Spotify have bought or commissioned to be made that although are made by artists, because some of these people, they're more like Muzak in a lift, or
yeah,
it's
yeah.
created for the purpose of filling the air rather than an artist's vision behind them.
Yeah, it's supposed to just be there is usually the thing, you know.
Yeah.
It tends not to.
And obviously they do that because they then don't have to pay a royalty on it.
Yeah.
And they can make more money.
Yeah. So with all that going on, it's kind of like ambient. It felt like ambient music was never going to find much attention there because of what was going on. And it was, I mean, it's a funny thing to talk about because it sounds like I'm just, you know, braying on about how great we are, and it's not really that. It's that there was just this sense of, like, there's a great kind of ads wizard from yesteryear called Dave Trott, who's this sort of marketing guru, but in a very refreshing kind of sensible way, not a Gary Vaynerchuk kind of way. And he always says this thing about, you know, in the face of a problem of to how to take something to market, you should always try and look to swim upstream to where the problem maybe doesn't exist yet and things like that. And it was very much an application of that logic with Moby, of, like, we were looking around and going, hang on. At the time, I was using an app called Calm, which I used to help fall asleep with sleep stories and stuff like that. And Calm is an app that is just, it's all about sort of relaxation. It's meditation. It's got a lot of sort of new agey type music in there. It does sleep stories. That's just people like Stephen Fry reading stuff in a very gentle, slow voice to send you off to sleep. And it's got 45 million people using it worldwide. And we were looking at that and we're like, well, they don't have any music by anyone you know. It's same, probably just production music again, you know, blah, blah, blah. But this could be great for Moby to take him to a bunch of people that, of course, a bunch of them will know Moby and may already be fans. But the law of averages says that among 45 million people, there's a bunch of them who are either lapsed or haven't heard of him or weren't aware that he made this type of music.
Who, yeah, might have left at Animal Rights.
Yeah, yeah. You know, any of those sorts of things. So, you know, we got in touch with Calm. You know, my colleague Tom did. And you know, spoke to them and they were kind of like, yeah, you know, we'd love to do this. And it, you know, there was the, and so cutting a long story short, you know, the album was on Calm exclusively for a month and, you know, they emailed 40 million people about it. I think the impressions on it in the news was something like 100 million, you know, millions of plays, and basically a response to that record that, you know, I can confidently say would have exceeded by a factor of 10 kind of what it would have just got had it have just been sort of serviced in a normal manner to Spotify.
I can't remember who,
Spotify,
maybe, who it
remember.
Was, but there was when Ragu, the Prego Ragu Pasta Sauce Wars, a couple of decades ago, the phrase "there's no perfect pasta sauce" came. And it was this realisation that they at the time were both trying to sell like two different sauces.
Yeah.
And they were head to head. And it was for Prego, I think, that whoever the marketeer was, he went out and did surveys and asked people what they wanted. And this guy wanted chunky and they wanted garlic. And he realized that there wasn't just one path, there were many. And now when you walk into a supermarket, And obviously we don't have Prego over here, but how many different types of ragu are there? It's just like an aisle all to itself of just different flavours. And I suppose that is something, as a creator, we need to learn, that there's not just that one route to the audience. Weirdly, this podcast didn't... Originally, I wanted to make a music podcast.
Right.
And I've been talking to Pip for years about doing this podcast, at least two. And I wanted it to be a music podcast, and I wanted to present stuff that people wouldn't have heard that I loved.
Yeah.
And make a lot of effort in finding those Bandcamp bands and finding those artists who aren't going to get hit by the algorithm.
Yeah, yeah.
And then obviously I realized that paying PRS and stuff was just not like... when I had no intention of trying to make money from a podcast,
yeah,
it changed my perception of it, that I would then have to do this music thing with the intention of making money to pay. Even though, like, if it wasn't a success, it would only be 50 quid every 3 months. But if as soon as it got past, like, 3,000 plays in 3 months, which we're well past that now, it would start costing me cash. So I was like, okay, okay. And then I realized that I make a vast amount of ambient music. You know, I'm up to, I think my little ambient playlist of stuff I've created on in my iTunes is 16 hours.
Right.
And I was like, maybe that's it. That's what I thought, I can make an ambient playlist. And I was going for an equally on the nose name as Moby's, Ambient Hours. Just having these. And the only reason I didn't do it was just because of that. It didn't... It was already doing... Making that stuff was already fulfilling me.
Yeah.
I didn't need to put it in the world to gain some other thing.
Yeah.
But having these conversations seemed more important. Seemed more like I was gonna... More important for me. I don't care about you, listeners, as you well know, as I tell you regularly. Don't go. But yeah, like, we are in this weird place where we see how things have succeeded and we want to copy that.
Yeah.
Yet, at the same time, we're constantly like, well, this is bad about our industry. And it's a really odd thing of how we find our way through that, you know.
But I think you just, you know, it's just seeing where opportunity lies. You know what I mean? And I think that's what annoys me is, the Moby thing should be looked at, which I know sounds terrifically arrogant, but should be looked at more for just that thing of like, you know, why do people just assume that it's kind of like, I've made a record, can I get the record playlisted on Spotify?
Yeah.
And it's like, there are a million other things going on. Why do you have to go there? You know, there are different places to take music, different ways to be heard and understood.
And that's the thing as well, like, that when people... When you talk about Spotify, people say, well, I buy merch.
Yeah.
Okay. Merch only makes money if you've got some level of following. You know, like... Spending like on good quality t-shirts,
there is cost
there, so a lot of bands won't be able to afford to do that.
Yeah,
well, I go to see them live, okay. That yes, that might help, but again, if they're a small band, they're only getting a small fee,
yeah,
so it might not be helping them that much. But also, what about a left field electronic producer who the only scene for what they do is in Berlin? And they're in Stockport.
Yeah.
You know, like, for those people, it's learning that it doesn't always help. And I think Spotify have been very good at building this propaganda of that even the smallest artists can succeed on there. And it's like, but they don't. You know?
But I think what always annoys me is they always go, well, here's X, you know, and X has now had hundreds of millions of streams, and you're like, but I'm not X.
Yeah.
And that's just one lightning strike, which it's not a model that you rinse and repeat for everyone to get a thing. And, you know, and there's been people who've said, you know, with a degree of truth, I think, that, you know, it was never easy, and it's not like there's no, you know, you're not entitled just because you made something for it to be played by everybody and heard by everyone. But I think what frustrates me is just that there's many, many things like platforms and destinations that kind of pull you away from the cause, a sort of deviation from the most obvious course. And the most obvious course is own the channel of communication with your fans, and then you're not subject to algorithms and the whims of Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all these as to how many people see your post and stuff like that. Now, that's not to say that social media has no value, but with all of our artists, we keep banging the drum about this thing of like, great, you've got 50,000 followers on this platform or that one, but that's not the end point. The end point should be that you try and kind of upstream them into email or even web notification systems, the browser pushes, because then everyone gets those. You're not subject to an algorithm. And those things are hyper efficient at driving sales. And I keep saying to people, it's like, there's a reason if you I don't use Facebook barely ever. I mean, I've got an account because I need one for work, but there's a reason Facebook keeps emailing me saying, blah has posted an update, Darren. It's because 9 times out of 10, that shit works.
Yeah.
So even social media people know, the platforms know that email works as a means to drive a response. So there's these things where it's like, looking at any of our artists, the most money is generated via channels like email.
Mm-hmm.
And working on those channels, it counts.
Mainly,
but it's not a fashionable answer, going, well, actually, email's pretty
good.
Everyone's
like, mailing list.
No, it's not, mate. I'm like, I'm all about the Instagram. And you're like, well, yeah, fine. But then Instagram... even the term social network is hilarious because it's an ad network. It's always a fucking ad network.
Yeah.
It's Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, name your pick, they're all ad networks. But they gave it this, it's a beautiful bit of subterfuge to go, it's not an ad network. It's not that, Dan. It's a social network. So you tell your mates about what you're up to and they'll love that and you get that validation loop. It's an ad network.
If you are on a social network... I genuinely believe you're an unpaid intern for that company. Every tweet you make is generating traffic for Twitter to serve adverts. And it's a bizarre thing. It weirdly sort of off the point, but when people used to tell me about how music should be free, especially around Pirate Bay and the Pirate Party, the political wing, and they would talk about democratizing of music and how it was better for everyone if it was free. The one thing no one ever really talked about was just how much fucking money they were making on ads on Pirate Bay,
Well, it's like the same saying that people say, is like, Google hates copyright, but they're half bloody fond of a patent. And it's that same thing of like, well, you seem very anti-copyright, and yet... anyone treads on your patents and you're down on them with all the force on the planet.
Yeah.
And it's the same shit, it's just different names, but same deal. So it just doesn't stack up. And I think that's the thing for us increasingly is sort of, we're moving now. We've started managing a friend of mine, Wrong Tom. And part of the reason and it was sort of me, Matt and Tom, and Matt and Tom are directors in Motive Unknown. We were sort of talking about this, and there was this kind of thing of what would happen if we managed an artist, because we work with a lot of bands that have hit a sort of certain level, and they're already there.
You mentioned earlier you're working with the up and coming Spice Girls.
Yes, they're one of our clients. Yeah,
and indie rock. I can't remember.
Yeah, got a lot of promise. But working with those sorts of artists and they're already there, so there is an audience already. But there's a sort of, there's tiers of artists below that just aren't at that sales potential, I suppose, if we're going to be crass about it. And we deliberately wanted to go back to this and say, okay, let's take someone like Tom, who's a great friend of mine, and just kind of look at what he's doing. And it's not about money. There's nothing to do with money in it. But it was just a case of, can we take somebody that isn't at that kind of lovely high level where they've got hundreds of thousands of people, and what can we do for them? And how can we change this for them? And it's been really interesting to sort of be talking with him and going, do you do this? And no. Why not? Well, and it's interesting even with Tom, where it's like he kind of, I don't think he's got a website because he basically pivoted to social media, and it was like, all right, well, that's your first mistake.
Yeah.
There's no destination. Email list, same, kind of like got pretty much kicked to the curb in the face of social media. And all these things that actually were the most valuable channels got kind of put to one side because all around you is this sense of like, no, you know, you must be on these things. So it was like, I got that real kind of buzz of excitement reading that, I think was it Nils Fram kind of just said, look, you know what? I don't like Facebook. I don't like what they stand for. And I don't like what it represents as an interaction with me. So I'm not going to play that game anymore. I'm off.
Yeah.
And if you want me, I've got a website. You can find me. And this is the thing we always say. It's like, we say this a lot in music marketing. It's like labels get so obsessed with this idea of like, you know, there's a new Dan and Pip record out and we must advertise it as like, listen now on Spotify. And everything about the advertising is like, stop what you're doing right now and go and listen to the whole album.
Yeah.
And it's like, no one does that. Nobody. And I always, my analogy is like, you're walking down the street and I, you know, you're on your way to meet someone. And I just step out from behind a lamppost and I'm like, you're right, Dan. Got a new record here I think you might like. And you might be sat there going, oh.
Oh, cool.
I mean, yeah, okay. But I'm on my way to meet someone. So not now, but maybe, you know, I might circle back later. And people are like, no, yeah, can you stop now and listen? It's like, no. And you fuck off. And it's sort of, and we treat people like they're too stupid to go later on and check this stuff out. And it's the, you know, it's a thing that really, really makes my blood boil in music marketing is like everyone's very, you know, they just, it's like straight to the end thing. You know, it's like going into a bar and just seeing a beautiful lady if you're a singer and just being like, you're right, do you want to have sex? And then be like, wait, no. You know,
that doesn't work.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. I feel
suddenly it all becomes clear. No, it's that, but you know what I mean? It's that thing of just like, yeah, just, you know, there's a crawl, walk, run kind of thing going on there. And we're too myopic in that sense. And it drives me wild. And it, you know, seeing these people where they'll turn around and just say, I'm not going to play that game, but I know that you're all smart enough to find me.
Yeah.
So me disappearing off Facebook doesn't mean I'm going to fucking vanish in a puff of smoke. You'll find me. I just won't be here. And I really wish more artists would do that rather than, because the number I've seen where, like, you know, I remember sitting at one point, I had to kind of audit what we were doing with Run the Jewels and realise that we'd set up something like, I think between the guys individually, and they run their own stuff, so that's for them to manage. But factoring that in and the official band channels, there was something like 14 ways to talk to fans.
Yeah.
And I was just like, this is ridiculous, you know. We've fallen in that trap of like, just because it's there, we've got to now service that as well. I said, no, you don't. You just, so, you know, a bit of quiet culling is needed to just go, you know what, we're here, and if
this
you...
This is where we are.
And it's fine, and you'll find us. And just have the confidence to, you know, that people will know where you are to connect. And so there's just, you know, that whole side of it, I think, is interesting, and it sort of feels like even now a big part of what we do is to sort of, you know, unfuck all of the horrors from that these people have had, you know, over the last 10 years of like, you must do this, that and the other, and, you know, don't buy into it. I mean, it's interesting, like, even looking at someone like Pip, because Pip as an individual is definitely, you can see he's got that mindset of like, well, hang on, if I can do this myself, why would I involve somebody else?
Yeah, Pip's like always been the hardworking, like, independent guy who wants to do it himself and wants to do it his way, and his way has proven correct on multiple occasions.
In a weird way for me, it was like the work with Dan and Pip in a weird way predated the sort of mindset of Run the Jewels, and there's definite similarities there in the sense of it wasn't like with you and Pip the releases were sort of self-released and things like that, which is where Run the Jewels are now. They're kind of I'm actually not such a rare example these days. It's more common, but an example of a band where they literally, you know, they are their own label and they are their own business and everything else. They're not really in hock to anybody in beyond that. But there was just this thing of, you know, that sense of like, if we can do it ourselves, should we be doing it? And I think there was just that understanding that you can take the leap and it won't, you know, it shouldn't spell doom, you know. And yeah, it's just sort of fascinating in that sense of, you know, the dealing with you guys first time round and the seeing the thought processes at work even then to where I am now working with people like RTJ, where it's a similar thing.
So what you're really saying, and probably a positive note to end on, is that Run the Jewels owe me and Pip all their success. Essentially, it's kind of that might be an interesting
maybe.
Take.
But, yeah, yeah, maybe.
You know, maybe.
Who knows?
Like, just saying.
Who knows? Yeah, I mean, you know, with all these things, it's you carry everything that went before with you, you know, and you learn and reapply.
Philosophy Tube, this episode 6, talked about when he was at drama school, he's got a degree in an MA in philosophy and an MA in acting. Mm. And something they do in drama is they give you a canvas, like a group of you, and you get to paint on it.
Mm.
And then you have to hand that canvas over to someone else. And then the person next to you can either continue what you've done or just white out what you've done
and start
fresh.
Yeah.
And you do that and then you let it dry. And then when you look at that, everything that was covered in white, you can still see what was underneath.
Yeah.
And it's like, no matter how much, like all your previous experience, whether you're editing out something you started writing and you pivot to something else, that work is still there. And it's always going to be there. You know?
Yeah.
Like, from a personal perspective, I still know that Stunner, which is one of the favourite tracks I ever wrote with Pip, I know that's from things I was doing on a 4-track tape deck and with delay pedals and stuff.
Yeah,
that was still there, and although I may have moved away from it, it always comes back, you know. And it's definitely an interesting thing, like how artists grow yet carry things through them, and how that affects everyone. You know, it's not just a creative thing, because you can have a job that your job is quite techie and quite in front of a computer, but you're still having to create.
Yes.
Solutions to problems.
Or all the time.
Or solutions to questions that haven't been asked yet. And that requires creativity.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I asked you on. Because I think people don't really... I think most people don't realise how creative their daily life is.
Yeah.
Like, even the person with the most mundane job in the world is having some creative
input. Finding solutions to stuff. Because, you know, in any... You know, you work... Everyone works, for the most part. And within that, you're normally, you know, part of your job will be improving things or finding better ways of doing it or stuff like that. I mean, it's something within Motive Unknown we've tried to nurture, is that sort of creative thing. You know, I quite like that thing of Google that they used to do with the sort of 20% projects.
Mm.
So you could use 20% of your time to just sort of do pet projects.
Yeah.
And... I just like the idea that someone's 20% of someone's time was sort of just sort of creative thinking with no necessary sense of like, okay, what's the return on investment
going to
be?
Yeah.
So within what we do, there's you know, I like to maintain that, and it connects to things like well-being again, of, you know, if people are happy and healthy, they're thinking freely and they're, you know, the best thoughts are coming through.
Mm.
And it's what has allowed us, I think, to build something that, you know, it feels quite special in the sense that, you know, it's allowing us to bring opportunities and to sort of, you know, I know it sounds a bit like you're getting a bit on your horse about it, but I feel like we are coming at it differently and trying to find solutions for people that, you know, better nurture a relationship between the artist and the fan. And it goes back to that thing of like, you kind of can have your cake and eat it. Like, you can help an artist do great things with fans in a genuine and meaningful way, and it not just be a cynical like, yeah, we'll help you, you know, sell 100,000 units, but we'll, you know, fuck over all your fans in the process, or make sure that they'll never buy a record from you again, you know, and be true to the thing at the heart of it. And I think that sort of that attitude is not as prevalent as it should be in the music business. And I think within this, if we can nurture that all the more, then we're all the better for it.
Hey there. Hang on, let me get a sip of coffee. Not that I need any more. I'm talking very fast today. That was delightful. I hope you enjoyed that. That was Darren Hemmings again, if you didn't listen to the intro. If you skipped that, that's very rude. I spent time on that. But yeah, I hope you found that interesting. Darren knows a lot about the music industry, and it was really nice for me to just sit down and have those conversations, and I don't know, I think we think about it very similarly, and I think we tackled actually some big things about how we approach the things we love, you know, like realizing that if you want a thing to exist, you might need to do more than give a corporation money. You might have to go and find a way of supporting the creator directly, you know, like some of you do on patreon.com/DanLasak. Wow, that was a segue. That was good. That was a really good one. But yeah, again, hope you enjoyed it. Next time's guest, which is in a fortnight, I can't now say next week's guest. I'm going to have to think of a better way of saying that. On the next episode, that's it already, nailed it. See, creativity, a bit of creative thinking there. On the next episode is a, I don't know what you'd call him, innovator, electronic musician, performer, just, you know, those people who are way more talented than should be allowed. It's one of those. It's one of those people. So yeah, that'll be in a fortnight. And I'm off recording more episodes. I've got maybe 5 or 6 booked in between now and the first week of June. I'm going to be a busy boy making podcasts for you all. Anyway, go spread the good word on my behalf. Go check out danlasak.bandcamp.com for all the musical music you'll ever need. And I'll see you very, very soon on the next episode of Falling Forward with Dan Lasak. Wait, did I put that in the intro? Hey, I'm going to have to dub in saying that in the intro. But you won't know I dubbed it in until afterwards. The magic of editing. Hey, welcome to episode 8 of Falling Forward with Dan Lasak. That's how it will work. I'll just edit that in. Have fun. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.